This is an Apple I computer on breadboards that runs Wozniak's ROMs from 1977, and my dad made the board in the back. So, like, I like doing kits like this because it reminds me that we took lightning, aimed it at a rock, and now we think that that rock thinks.
Welcome to Leading the Shift, a podcast for Microsoft Azure where we hear from the people at the forefront of data, AI, and cloud technologies. I'm your host, Susan Ettlinger.
Hey everyone, Susan here. We have an incredible guest today. It is Scott Hanselman, who is the VP of Developer Community at Microsoft. Scott is, I think he's a renaissance guy. Like he's just everywhere. He is everywhere from like deep into sort of the TikTok world all the way into, I think you play Scott as well in TikTok as you do in LinkedIn, which is really an accomplishment I think you should feel proud of. But actually, you know, as somebody who has sort of has that kind of aerial view of what's going on in the developer community, that's what we wanted to talk about today. And so I'm really thrilled to have you here. I love your shirt. There are two types of people in the world: those who can extrapolate from incomplete data. And so that's what we're going to do today. We're going to extrapolate from incomplete data. Scott, welcome, welcome, welcome. So great to have you.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, I like being on multiple sides of the internet. So the juxtaposition between TikTok and business Facebook over at LinkedIn, I've been an internet person since its inception, and certainly since early, before Eternal September. Do you remember Eternal September?
What's Eternal September?
Eternal September was in late 1993 when they let all the AOL users, all the America Online users, onto the internet.
That was when
they gave people the internet.
Yeah.
And like all the people who were already on the internet were like, oh no.
Yeah. No, I
regulars are showing the muggles are coming.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that also happened in 2005, right? Where they let non-university students be, you know, onto Facebook, which seemed like a huge deal at the time. Mm-hmm. It feels like ancient history now. So what was your first social network that you actually were on?
My first social network was probably in 1986. It would have been FidoNet via a BBS system. I had a bulletin board system. I pulled wire from the telephone line to my parents' garage and ran a dual line bulletin board system on an operating system called IBM OS2 Warp and ran the Wildcat BBS. And people would dial into my parents' house, my separate line, and leave messages. And then FidoNet would make short, non-long-distance phone calls, and then we would bounce email across America making non-long-distance calls. So you know, if I sent you an email, you wouldn't get it for, overnight.
Mm, okay. And but what did you talk about back in 1986?
C programming. I think the Kernighan and Ritchie C was around. We would email Don Knuth and ask him questions about his books. And it was a smaller, quieter internet. We'd play what were called door games, where you would call the bulletin board and then you would open a door to another game. And then the bulletin board system would exit. The door game would jump up, pick up the call, and then you'd play Trade Wars and different multiplayer games. It was all text-based. So that thing was going.
It was a simpler time.
And
you just got back from Microsoft Build not too long ago. I saw your TikTok. I love this TikTok where you went and you visited the 50-year anniversary booth. And just, I'll have to do a visual description for you all. But like, just imagine those like wonderful OG, orange and brown wallpaper and these wooden bookshelves. And was it an Altair on the desk?
There was an Altair 8800 on the desk, and it was a an earth-toned kind of burnt sienna, orange and brown, corduroy pant kind of a time. It was meant to be evocative of what it would be like to work in the 1970s, and it was not just a set. It was a Disneyland-level experiential installation where you would sit down at a desk. You would get a note from Bill Gates and Paul Allen, And you would be asked to debug some of their code. And then we dropped you into an environment which was all built with modern computers, but they were put inside old computers. Mm. So you had like a CRT cathode ray tube that was green and kind of warped like back in the day. So we had put filters on top of that. And then the phone would ring and someone would be on the phone talking to you. And there were Easter eggs and VHS videotapes and floppy disks. It was a ride.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, it looked amazing. I have to say, though, I don't know where everybody was in 1975. I will not disclose where I was, but like there was so much scotch tape and so many staplers, like, and a hole punches. Like, it just, one of the things about that desk is that it just reminded me like how much stuff you needed in order to be able to put documents together and deal with documents in the world.
Yeah.
And like that cognitive load is gone.
Well, do you remember why those hole punches were dually or doubly important?
So you could put things in binders?
Do you remember the notch on the side of the floppy? Why would you need a hole punch on the other side? Because you would punch a notch on the other side so you could flip the floppy over and use both sides.
Both sides, right, right, right.
The first very important the first life hack that we knew back in the day.
I love that you just pulled a floppy out of the air.
I can not only do that, I don't know if people can hear this and see this. Is that the case?
Yes. Well, on YouTube, they can hear it.
Well, you can narrate that. Okay. Scott is getting up from his desk.
Okay.
Now.
All right. All right. Guest gets up from his desk, walks across his office, picks up something, brings it back. It is a keyboard, my friends.
This is a Commodore 64 keyboard that I'm refurbishing.
Oh, my goodness.
So that's a 1984 Commodore 64, and I'm putting it together in the back here.
Wow. Okay. All right. So this is a walk down memory lane. So now let's do a little bit of a fast forward, like we're 40 years later, and the world is so, so different. Oh, God, no, it's 50 years later, and the world is so, so different. It was really interesting to sort of locate that moment in time, you know, not only for Microsoft and its anniversary, but just kind of that moment in time for technology, because it was just, in many ways, a completely different world. Although by 1985, I suppose arguably you could say that AI was 35 years old, at least the idea of it, right? The idea of it, if you count back from the Dartmouth conference and Alan Turing and, you know, just sort of the beginnings of can machines think and what does this all mean to us? But here we are today in this world where we are, you know, we have more data, more algorithm, you know, more and faster and better algorithms, more compute power. And, you know, Build was a pretty big milestone, it felt like, in terms of what landed. What was the mood like on the floor? Like when you were talking to developers, what were they thinking, feeling, asking?
I think it was probably the first / best build where we had reduced our COVID stiffness.
Mm.
You know, people, I think there's a generation of people that are just a little awkward because we were trapped in our houses and not shaking a lot of hands and talking to humans. So this was the first build post-COVID that really popped, I thought was cool. I think people are still trying to get their minds around what AI will do for them and whether or not it will affect their work and their jobs. I think there's a meme, for lack of a better word, of like, AI is going to take your job. And I think it's useful to tease apart that it's not AI that's going to take your job. It is capitalism that will take your job. AI is a new tool, just like I remember, as we talked about at the beginning of the show, when the internet was invented and when the iPad was invented and when the cell phone was invented and when I went from a BlackBerry to an iPhone. Like each one of these things was a big shift that enabled to capitalism to do things, but the tech in itself is neutral, you know, in some ways. So there were some subtle things I hope people picked up on. I saw a couple of notes on LinkedIn that were really useful that juxtapose Microsoft's perspective on AI versus others. One of them is this coding agent that was launched, where you assign it to do work. So like, you know, you have a website and you want to center a div and you say, oh, I have to go and figure out how to center a div. That's tedious work. It's the kind of work that maybe robots could do. Robots do work that is dull, dirty or dangerous. And centering a div in HTML is probably all of those. And when you assign it that work, then the question is, who owns the work? And this is an interesting user interface question, but it's also an interesting philosophical question. If you're in a car and it's maybe not self-driving, but at the very least, it's trying to stay in the lane, and you take your hands off the wheel and you hit something, whose fault is it? Is it the car's? Is it the engineer? Well, ultimately, you're in the car. It's your fault. That's my perspective. So when you assign something to an AI agent, a coding agent in this case, one of the little user interface nuances is that it says the coding agent has started work on behalf of Susan. And that little small thing, on behalf of, is an acknowledgement that your hands are on the wheel. And you have maybe chosen to take them off, but you're going to come back later and put them back on the wheel. And I like that. When you go and look at the logs, it's like, oh, Susan did that. You know, her agent, her paralegal, her enthusiastic intern did that work. And I think you will see more enthusiastic people of perhaps a different perspective happily taking their hands off the wheel, closing their eyes and leaning back and saying, oh, yeah, the coding agent will do all the work. That's not my perspective. And I don't think that is Microsoft's perspective either, because of those small user interface things that show where the onus is.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. And, you know, it gets to that core meaning of the word agency, right? There's this thing called human agency, which we have. And, you know, when I think about, for example, the mission of Microsoft, it's a mission of empowerment. It's not an issue. It's not a mission of ceding control or ceding responsibility. It's a mission of empowering people with technology, not, you know, the other. So, you know, I think that's really important. When we think about agents, we need to think about agency and who's responsible for what. And that is, you know, we're in the churn right now. Like, it just feels like we're in that moment where things are moving so quickly and it's so hard to conceptualize. So I agree with you. I think, you know, that's very much the ethos. What about, you know, as you were walking the floor and people were coming up to you with questions or comments, like, what did you hear?
FUD, fear, uncertainty, and doubt. Mm-hmm. I think that AI will make the incurious less curious, which I think is problematic. I think that we are in a time right now, at least in North America, where a large number of people don't read books, haven't read a book since college. And I don't think AI is going to help that. If you are someone who is not interested in exploring things beyond the surface, then I think you're going to have a challenge. So we need to think about younger people and earlier in career people who aren't, for lack of a better word, like fully formed. Their prefrontal cortex is still developing, and think about how do we use AI to make them more curious and engage them in ways that were not possible before. I remember when the calculator, pocket calculator, came out, and they were like, oh, well, you never have to learn math again. And that's not exactly what happened. But for some folks now, we have a pocket supercomputer that we use to argue with strangers on the internet with. Why do I need to think when I have this thing?
Yeah.
So I'm a little concerned about that. I worry about that. Generating crap is too easy with AI. I use it to brainstorm rather than to generate crap.
So let's dig into that, because, you know, every technology innovation probably over the last 500 years, let me go back to the Gutenberg Bible. You know, the Gutenberg Bible now.
Movable type, baby. Movable type.
Movable type changed the world. And so every, the telegraph, you know, everything changed the way that we think about the way, or, you know, work is organized. And then there's always a group of folks who are, you know, worried and concerned, and very often rightly so, right? But then you look at what happened afterwards and you start to see those knock-on effects. I don't know that we can or should, frankly, philosophize too much about those knock-on effects. But, you know, if you think about the sort of the life of the developer now, they're moving from a place of a high degree of professionalism and, you know, relying on their own innate curiosity and relentlessness in solving problems to a place where maybe it is a little easier for them because so many things are more automated. And one of the things that I'm curious about is, you know, coming back to your point, what are the things that make people curious and how can we kind of foster that? Because I think that that's the key. I've always thought that that's the key, that curiosity leads to so many, you know, it leads to all sorts of human innovation.
Yeah, I agree with that. There's two things to tease out there. First, there's the engineers and what they like to work on versus what they're being asked to work on. And then there's the curiosity question. So a lot of engineers want to work on interesting, fun, innovative new stuff, but they are asked to do what I would call text boxes over data.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I got some data, put some text boxes over it. Nah, it's a website. And then it's just forms, right? Post, redirect, get. That is kind of enterprise software. And it is arguably not fun. It's somewhat dull. However, it has also enabled a huge amount of people to have comfortable, livable wages. So if one were to commoditize text boxes over data, whether it be with high-level tools like Power Platform or extremely high-level tools where you can just draw a picture of what you want on a napkin, take a picture of it, and then some agent goes and generates the text boxes over data website, even though it is universally not controversial to say that this is boring and dull work, it's still honorable work.
Sure.
That said, like I run my podcast and my website at Hanselman.com and the family of websites as if it's a company or an international corporation, but it's just me, right? So the cloud has enabled me to scale that. I've got, you know, a CDN, a content distribution network, so that if someone in India hits my site, they're going to get a speedy site.
Yeah.
Before, it was just a server under my desk. And now it's got a server in India and a server in Japan. And that's something that is now enabling me to multiply myself. If you add on a coding agent that I can assign the basic work, the toil, and then I can do the fun stuff, then the question is, well, what's the fun stuff? And is there enough fun stuff to go around? Which then now brings us to curiosity. One has to have a curious and inquisitive mind in order to conceive of fun stuff. For some, that is challenging because there's higher level executive function that you want to be able to do in order to be curious and be excited and be enthusiastic as I am. But in order to do that, you have to kind of have your bills on auto pay and you have to be somewhat comfortable. So, you know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs comes in directly inversely proportional to how curious I am. You know what I mean? If I don't know where my next sandwich is going to come from, then I'm going to be less excited about building a robot. Like this weekend, I'm going to continue to pull things in from off screen. This weekend, I built this robot from a Raspberry Pi because I wanted to have it pick stuff up and hand it to me. So it's a tank, and there's a Raspberry Pi inside. Here's the Raspberry Pi, and it's got like an arm. So I'm working on this robot on my desk here, and I finished most of it on Sunday. But that's not really possible without free time.
Yeah.
And, you know, it cost me $100 and $100 worth of you know, my wife gives me an allowance, so I use my allowance to buy this. Those things are all required. So I want people to have access. Sorry, my answers are so long-winded, but I'll try to be complete. For example, I was in Johannesburg in January and, you know, very conscious and aware that they're flying me in from the West Coast of the U.S. to talk to folks in Southern Africa about AI, it would be thoughtless for me to say, all right, everyone, pull out your credit card and everyone can sign up for right. ChatGPT, because maybe not everyone has a credit card there because they do their money differently. And maybe not everyone has data on their phone. So we had to sit and think about the context within which people in the Global South exist, which is different than other countries, et cetera, et cetera. And the demo that I did was in airplane mode on a phone without data to enable people to talk to an AI on their phone. We can make technology available and accessible to people and meet them where they are and then give them that kind of emotional space to be curious and play. But we need to make sure that we're not doing it the same way for for every country because everyone's coming at it differently.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, our last episode actually featured, or one of our last episodes featured Jairo Trod, who's the CEO and founder of a company called Colimo. They're a climate tech company based in Argentina. And he was talking about how his first company failed. And I asked him why. And he said, well, because we spent a lot of time building the tech and not a lot of time talking to farmers. And so with Colimo, what they did, like they literally drove 50,000 kilometers, which don't ask me to do the math, but it's what, like about, you know, a lot of miles around Argentina to meet with farmers in these incredibly remote, hot, harsh locations where, you know, they came in, a bunch of young kids, and they're like, we can help you with satellite data. We can help you change the way you do farming. And the farmers are like, are you kidding me? I've been doing this for 50 years. But, you know, one of the things I loved about it was that discipline around building the empathy and around understanding where, you know, not just the generalities around like we meet people where we are, but like specifically in this moment as a builder, as a developer, like what do I need to do in order to make this thing practical for you, pragmatic and workable?
Yeah. And our, you know, I said human in the loop. Human in the loop is not just an AI control thing. It's human in the loop at every point. Like if we're making stuff and we're not making it for people to make their lives better, then what are we doing?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So from my perspective, there is technology for joy, which is what I'm doing. You can see behind me in my office, like most of my technology is frivolous. There's no value in that little robot other than the value that I derive from it. But I'm learning, right? The whole point was to be able to do a project to learn. But if, you know, there is a lot of startups and Bay Area people whose feet have never touched the ground their whole lives who are building what they perceive to be the next, you know, Uber for blank.
Yeah.
Or,
yeah,
you know, taco drones for whoever. But like, did we ask for that stuff? And talking to humans about their problems is the point. So either I'm creating art, which is frivolous, and that's value, that's a thing, or I'm creating solutions for actual human beings. But I don't think there's much of a middle ground for me.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I think, you know, that's what this project is in a lot of ways. Like the technology is so incredible and so far advanced, and you can use it to reduce cognitive load. You can use it, and actually this is what Jairo was talking about, you can use it to solve real problems. And to do that, you have to engage meaningfully with your community, right?
So, yeah, and empathy is hard.
Yeah.
And empathy also requires a certain amount of spoons. Yeah. One has to be, again, a certain level in the hierarchy of needs in order to have that level of empathy, because if you're focused on your next meal, then empathy can be more challenging.
Right, right. So, you know, so developers' lives are changing. We know we're seeing more AI infused into DevOps. We're seeing more AI infused basically into the entire software development life cycle. One of the things I heard about at Build, which I thought was interesting, was this idea of vibe coding. And I looked it up because, you know, I have to do this. And can you, like, is this a thing? Like, is it?
Yeah, so it's a thing, but it's all, the problem is that things, branding is a lot. Right now we're in a time where everyone's tired and everyone's overwhelmed. And if something has good mouth feel, then it gets stuck in one's mouth, right? It's, you know, Twitter succeeded not just because it's fun to say Twitter, but it's also fun to say tweet, you know? It was less fun to say MySpace and less fun to say CompuServe, right? Like branding. So AI is not new, but it's, you know, it was a great brand pivot on machine learning, deep learning, and generative pre-trained transformers, right? ChatGPT is a weird word, but it had good mouthfeel.
Yeah.
And when those things happen, then people start to make this, you know, the avalanche starts to begin, right? And then the snowball starts rolling downhill and it's just like, it's fun to say vibe coding. We're just vibing, man. Hey, you know, you just think about Jeff Bridges just slapping the keyboard and everything's cool. I don't think that you vibe code into production, right? Mm-hmm. That could be myself as old man who shakes fist at cloud. But at the same time, vibe coding is kind of like the Jackson Pollock of painting, like certainly talented and the result was unmistakable, but it's easy to look at that and go, yeah, I could do that. I mean, he's just throwing paint at a canvas, right? When you vibe code, you talk to an AI or an agent like Copilot, and you tell it what you want, hopefully with the clarity of thought and the clarity of requirements that the results work. However, large language models are not deterministic, meaning that two people can say the exact words and get different code. So some people will insist that vibe coding is nonsense because it didn't work for me, right? I threw paint at the canvas and I'm not Jackson Pollock. And others will say, yeah, I became instantly more productive and I'm doing all my coding this way. The challenge is if you don't know how you got there, and this is where I think generational people of a certain age might agree with me, and people might say, yeah, this guy's a boomer. If you don't understand how this thing worked and it's a miracle to you, then when it breaks, what will you do?
Yeah.
So I did my painting analogy. Another analogy that probably people who know me are sick of hearing is, are you driving stick shift or are you taking an Uber? Uber would be software as a service, right? And, you know, building a kit car in your garage and driving it stick, or building, like, when I grew up, I built a go-kart, like 2-stroke engine from a lawnmower, welded the thing, built a car and drove it around. That was a thing that we did in the 80s. It was like not a weird thing. That change, and I believe that that changes your relationship with the vehicle in a fundamental way. Like it changes how you operate. We hear the word full stack developer, but I don't think we realize how deep the stack is.
Yeah.
I'm going to grab another piece of equipment. So yeah. Man gets up from chair.
Yep. Walks across room, disappears. Disappears, comes back, now has a...
So I built this. This is an Apple I computer on breadboards that runs Wozniak's ROMs from 1977, and my dad made the board in the back. So like, I like doing kits like this because it reminds me that we took lightning, aimed it at a rock, and now we think that that rock thinks. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like that's the bus between the registers and the CPU. Like there's 8 of them. And I can put an oscilloscope there and I can watch it. I can see the clock on the computer. That's not a flex. That's not a, hey, look at me, I'm old and I have disposable income. That is I can truly visualize the injection of the fuel into the cylinder and how the car propels forward. And as such, I believe that I have a different relationship with the vehicle than someone who orders an Uber and the Uber arrives and their 100-pound butt is transported by a 4,000-pound vehicle sitting on top of 150 years of internal combustion or electricity, depending. And then if the car breaks down, or the tires need to be changed or whatnot, my relationship with software as a service is one of appreciation and honor, because I know how deep the stack is.
Yeah.
So popping off the stack back over to vibe coding, that's a deep, deep stack.
Yeah.
And if it works, it's a miracle. If it doesn't work, whew, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like there's a lock. Who's going to fix that stuff?
Yeah. Where's the error? I mean, what you're saying though, it really resonates with me because it's a dedication to craft. And my hope, and it sounds like your hope, is that craft... That dedication to craft may be different for different people in different circumstances, right? There's this old, you know, MBA thing about core versus context, right? So the things that are core to you versus the things that, you know, the things that are core to you that you only you uniquely can do versus the things that you should automate because they are rote, they're repetitive, they're dirty, dangerous, or just not your thing. For me,
yeah.
I'm happy to take the rideshare service because I don't need to know how the engine works. There are other places where I want to be deep to, and you know, I'm not an engineer, but
I would argue that you know how the engine works because you explored it once and then you filed it away.
Mm.
I'm not saying act like that all the time. Like you've probably mowed your lawn before, I assume.
So, well, if I had a lawn, I live in a city.
But you know, like at some point in your life, you have pushed a lawnmower over a lawn. Fact?
No.
You've never in your life. Okay, well, maybe that's a bad analogy. I never had a lawn. See, there you go. So that's a great bit of context. So, for example, I have mowed the lawn for years, and then I got tired of it because it no longer fed my spirit. So then I hired a person to mow the lawn. Right. So there may be something in your life that is a similar analog. That's a thing that you did yourself.
True.
Maybe it's dry cleaning or laundry or whatever, and then you outsourced it. Yep. But I think that there's always value in doing it yourself once so that you understand it.
Mm.
And then outsource it. So what I'm proposing, I'm not trying to gatekeep computers, but I'm saying take a level that you are comfortable with, go one level lower. Like if you have a house cleaner, clean your house a couple times. You will then appreciate the house cleaner. You will appreciate the work and the talent and the skill that is involved in cleaning one's house. Maybe that's a better analogy.
I love that.
Lawnmowing.
And I think that it's a great place for us to wrap, because I think now we're getting into what do you think developers should be doing, thinking, working on? And really it's that focus on learning the thing, like learning the thing the old fashioned way. And then you can make the decision about what it is that you're going to delegate, right?
Yes. And always recognize that it's your hand on the wheel.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you should think about taking your hand, when you take your hand off the wheel, the decision and the context within which you exist. Why did I take my hands off the wheel? Because I'm responsible ultimately for the work and for producing this thing that I'm working on.
Okay. So we started with, you know, a ton of stuff happening, a ton of confusion, a ton of FUD, as you said early on. And we're ending on a note of intentionality, which I think is a beautiful place to
bingo. Deliberate practice. I approve.
All right. I love it. You're Scott Hanselman and you approve this message. Thank you so much for joining us. Really, really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Of course.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode. And as I'm sure you know, new podcasts live and die on engagement. So please like, comment, share, tell your friends, and let us know what you'd like to hear about. We're listening. If you'd like to learn more about how people and organizations are innovating with Microsoft Azure, visit azure.microsoft.com. The Leading the Shift podcast is a place for experts to share their insights and opinions. As students of the future of technology, Microsoft values inputs from a diverse set of voices. That said, the opinions and findings of our guests are their own, and they may not necessarily reflect Microsoft's own research or positions. Leading the Shift is a production of Microsoft Azure. I'm your host, Susan Ettlinger. Our executive producers are Haley Meehan, Aaron Russell, Eric Williams, and me. Production support provided by the incredible team at Indigo Slate.